This call is being recorded. Yeah. That's what it says. This call is being recorded. Okay.
Well, hi, everybody, and welcome. This is Dave Krueger. It's great to have you here. I don't know if some of you have – I know some of you have seen the email that I sent out, and I have some responses, and I appreciate that. And I want to spend just a few minutes, if you haven't responded by email, there are two questions that would help me in terms of looking at and configuring some of the things that we talk about. One is, if we were to sit down face-to-face right now, what is the most important or pressing question you have about this topic? And secondly, if you were to walk away from this seminar series saying it's one of the best seminar series you've ever attended, what would you take away? So any responses to either of those two questions, or just anybody want to say hi without having to respond to the question?
Good evening.
I'm sorry, say it again, please.
Yeah, good evening. My name is Atara.
Welcome. How are you?
Okay, really looking forward to tonight. And I did see your email, but it was at the time that I was just finishing work and getting ready to sit down for the course, so I can try to answer. And
okay,
the first answer, the first answer would be that since I work with couples and one big issue is finances, that if I was able to have some practical suggestions on how to diffuse the anger and disappointment created by financial differences, that would really be something that would be worthwhile for me.
Okay.
And if I walked away from the course with something that not only would help me help others, but would help me as a person grow, that would be great.
Okay. Well, you came to the right place. We're going to talk about that, and those are excellent questions, and I appreciate you you formulating that in such a coherent way that it will help guide me to be sure that we include that. So I appreciate it. So thank you, Atara. Who else?
Hi, this is Marlon Gentrell. Hi, Atara.
Hi, Marlon.
Atara, I take the same class.
Okay.
And since Atara answered the first question, I will dare to answer the second one. If you were to walk away from this seminar saying that was one of the best that you ever attended, what would you take away? What I envision is just taking away, having a redoing my blueprint. I don't know how else to put it, the blueprint of what my relationship with money is.
Okay.
Hello?
Let me ask each of you to manage the background noise at the beginning and the end of each of the seminars. I'd like to have a discussion and kind of an open mic night, but you have to share the mic and do only one at a time. So if you have any background noise whatsoever, even rustling a paper, if you would mute either the toggle switch on a headset or *6 so that there's not interference. The seminars will all be recorded, and I sent you the link where you can access the recordings. They'll usually be up the next day. So if there's anything you didn't quite get or didn't quite make sense, it'll be there, or if your schedule had a glitch that you weren't able to attend. So I want to be sure and get your was that your walk away to redo your blueprint about your money story?
That is correct.
Okay. Okay. I think you, this is a good précis of what we are going to be talking about from a different angle. As we look at what we do in mentor coaching, we're listening for how well a client's blueprint matches their life experience. If their blueprint, their set of beliefs and expectations and assumptions and their set of principles and rules, if that matches their experiences, then basically they're happy. If they're unhappy, it's because either the blueprint isn't working or their life experiences aren't working in the way that they want. So you have to change one or the other. And that's one of the things we do as mentor coaches, is to help someone understand the whole belief system, the whole blueprint that they operate on, to see what their beliefs, their assumptions are, to see which ones are working and which ones aren't. And that's where we become choice architects in helping someone to navigate change in terms of developing a story that is current and that is functional and optimum for success. So that's a great question, and we'll be talking about that in a number of ways. Now, each of you should have received, when you received that page, a link to print the outline, which will follow these four seminars that we do, and then also the workbook that will be something that each of you, I believe, can find the best benefit of our seminar series by doing the exercises yourself. When you have your story in a very clear and coherent way, you're going to be best able to help your clients develop their stories. And the fundamental process that you see, the roadmap system, we're applying it to Money Story, but it can apply to any story that someone has, a life story, a relationship story, a wellness story, career story. So when you have these fundamentals, I think you'll have the fundamentals of how to listen to and deconstruct a story and how to reconstruct one that is optimum for success, because these principles integrate psychology, neuroscience, quantum physics with strategic coaching. And we dollop a little bit of behavioral economics and neuroeconomics for the Money Story. So it's a synthesis of a number of disciplines come together in a coaching venue to look at what we can do to help someone understand and change their stories. Any other input? Any other responses to those two questions? What's your most important?
Hi.
Yes.
Sorry. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to join the class, and I really wanted to, so I was I had to register very, very late. In fact, it was in the last 10 minutes. So I don't have those.
You can redeem yourself by first saying your name, and then if you want to respond to either of the questions, you can.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear the questions. I don't have the questions. But my name is Sally Herndon, and I'm really excited about this for personal and professional reasons. I want to be able to – I'm moving into divorce coaching.
Excellent.
Like the other woman was saying, it's kind of – my target is women who are kind of reinventing themselves in whatever stage of divorce they're in. And a lot of times, and, you know, with myself as well, it's about reinventing your money story. So
okay, listen up, Sally Herndon. Here are the two questions. One is, if we were to sit down together face-to-face right now, what's the most important question about this topic that you have? And secondly, if you were to walk away from this series saying it was one of the best, most useful seminar series you've ever attended, what would you walk away with?
The most important thing about my money story is being able to have enough and not fear not having enough. And to make it the best course possible would be to have those questions answered and to feel that I could be at peace with that, and that anybody, I could help someone else feel at peace with that, so that it's not about
it's not worrying about what's going to happen tomorrow without enough money. It's about, you know, abundance and how it can flourish.
Okay, and we'll be talking about that because you're talking about two levels of conceptualization. One is a state of mind that includes abundance. Another is an endpoint, a goal. And to have an endpoint that is vague, like more, enough, later, is not to have an endpoint. So the first element would be to define what enough is, to know where the goal is, because if you don't have a specific destination, then any map will do. So this begins a journey to really look at that question in a specific way for each of you about, you know, what is enough. Let me just tell you a brief story that illustrates that before we get into the material. I sent around to different groups that I did keynotes for a number of years ago with a book that I had released at that time called Emotional Business, three different questions. And I put on an index card, 1, 2, 3, and they turned them in. Can I get a mute on the background noise? There's some shuffling and just some noise in the background. If you're not speaking, if you would mute, please, because it's your microphone is picking it up, and you may not hear it, but it does interfere. I can go on lecture mode, and I will when I begin to present, but I'd like to keep it open. So for these audiences, and these were you know, professional, executive people, a whole range of people. And I asked them three questions to put on their index card and turned it in anonymously. Number one, what does money mean to you? One word, first word that comes to mind. Number two, what is your current annual income? And number three, what would your current annual income need to be for you to be completely worry-free and happy about your money? And you can imagine the first question got a range of things, freedom, happiness, love, worth, a whole number of things. The second and third was that it would take, according to over 90% of the audiences, and this was several hundred people cumulatively, it would take about double for them to be happy and worry-free about their money. And this was as true for somebody who made $100,000, they thought it would take $200,000, as somebody who made $1 million and thought it would take $2 million. And there was a trailing double. In other words, for someone, as I did a follow-up, for people who thought they would be happy when they were making $50,000, if they would make $100,000, then when they got to $100,000, they thought it would take roughly $200,000 for them to be happy. So what this does is bring into focus what is good enough. What is the end point? So Sally's question about enough, I think, really crystallizes the whole concept that we'll be talking about in terms of how do we define that and do we have a destination so that we can achieve and feel effective and experience mastery around doing that. So I'm going to start. I'm going to put us on lecture mode, and I want to save some time at the end for other responses. Welcome to the Nuts and Bolts of Coaching Money Mastery. I'm really excited about collaborating with each of you to talk about how to understand money relationships and revise money stories. In the first seminar, we'll talk about your relationship with money and the power of your money story. The remaining three seminars, we'll look at the principles and practice of systematically understanding and changing that story. Now, as I mentioned, I've integrated information and research in psychology, neuroeconomics, behavioral economics to strategic coaching. So we're about to organize the Mind Matters and Brain Business into the ROADMAP system, the acronym for the 7-step process to understand your relationship with money and to change your money story. And these 7 steps are simply a deconstruction of the process of understanding a story, whether that's life, money, wellness, and a systematic way of constructing a new one. We're going to combine the art of fulfillment with the science of achievement. Although we'll discuss application to your money story, you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all change, growth, and success. My mission here to change the way you think, specifically to help you examine and understand your relationship with money and map new possibilities and choices to write a new money story. My hope? To guide you to look around the corner at the next years and decades of your life. What you do today can affect the quality and choices, perhaps even the longevity, of those tomorrows. My stretch goal, to have this work together that we're about to do, make a positive, powerful difference for you for the rest of your life. So, as we go through the seminars, as I mentioned, I'd suggest you actually do the exercises in the accompanying workbook. Then you're going to be in the best position to coach it. From Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. So, put it into action. So, first let's talk about your relationship with money. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to you. It's a story that you talk about every day, think about several times a day, is remarkably simple yet intricately complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you're gone. You might get 10 years out of a car, maybe 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it or run away from it or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. When I spoke with a well-known self-help guru, his response was, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change." You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted. At times, you've used this story to regulate your moods, adjust self-esteem, maybe influence others, soothe emotional pains. And how you live this story will be what you teach your children and your clients and employees. What they see in your behavior and hear even sense as your beliefs will be what they incorporate, internalize as their own. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you, you speak with it. And of course I'm talking about your money story. Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers. So, two money questions, and I'd suggest you write these down. What's your money story? And two, what would you ideally like your money story to be? Now, let's look at that a little bit more closely. What is a money story? A money story, your money story, is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, cash flow, net worth, salary. It's your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story is the secret language of money at work. It's the unconscious tale that you continually tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. It's a running dialogue about how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you feel capable of. It's also about what would happen if you had more or less. So let's look at some specifics here. How we speak with money. And this is all in your fairly annotated outline, so you don't have to take a bunch of notes. We speak first in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. It can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, yet also at times for what we fear or lack, or feel that we do, for what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, or follow. We use money to show how much we care, or maybe how little. We use it to measure success and try to buy happiness. We use it to bolster our self-esteem, regulate moods, influence others. In other words, we use money to communicate. We speak with money also as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and make it bigger than it really is. We use money as a self-statement. Money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All that you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements. And the story always tells most about the teller. For example, proclamation of freedom, a currency of caring, a promissory note for happiness, the embodiment of power, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, instrument of control. This is only the beginning of a huge list of how money can make any statement, how we use money to make our own personal statements. So when we see a new car and want it, what we're doing is acting on our money story. Just below our consciousness, we're adding a new plot line to our money story that says one of a few things. This car will show what I'm worth. This will make people respect me. This will validate me. This says money is freedom and I can do whatever I want to. An obvious example is the self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a bright red BMW and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy a bright new BMW in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, this is not a self-statement. I'd never buy a bright red BMW. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. Another way we use money, in self-talk. We use money in self-talk, in the messages we tell ourselves. Some of these internal beliefs include people who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. You have to work hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money will buy happiness. Money means the same to everyone. We use it in an external dialogue. Part of what keeps the money language a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create some unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not her age. We can debate financial markets and economies, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your next dinner party, how much money do you make? And you probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? And you may not see dessert. An agent at a writer's conference discussed working with her authors. This was an internationally known agent at a writer's conference I was at. She was discussing her relationship with authors over the years. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations. Someone in the audience finally asked, would you talk about how much money is involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? It was the one thing she hadn't talked about. She looked kind of shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I've always felt you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself. And there was a guy in the back row who said, I thought once you finish the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of your sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course he was right. His frankness and confrontation sparked a really lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter then revealed the specific figures involved and then finally went on to lead a discussion that was really useful to her audience, most of whom were interested in writing books for a living. Consider also in addition to the external dialogue, the internal dialogue. While we may speak openly of something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, our time and energy, for something else. And every exchange involves at least two prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, has many dialects. Some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton from my dad on hot summer days. School started, I saw my classmates enjoying the sodas and candies, and I joined them. Boom, my treats were gone. And I thought, was that candy worth half a row of chopping cotton? Will I get enough from a soft drink to pay one row of cotton chopping? Well, I soon answered no to both questions. And think about how this is something we often try to teach our children. We teach our children about the value of money, maybe doing an allowance so that we can become a collaborator instead of a dispenser, and we can collaborate about whether, you know, two alligators are worth one horse and a pony. But we can also talk about the cost of money and what money costs in terms of earning it, in terms of time and energy, and how much we're paying in terms of the cost of the money. At another example, at an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, "I'll give you what I never had as a child." Another example, the preamble of spending may be to rationalize. Well, you know, this seems like a lot of money to spend on an HD big screen TV set. But if I spread it out, if I amortize it over the next 9 years, it only costs 22 cents a day. And my wife said, "Dave, if you want the TV, just buy it." It's an example of rationalized spending. Another, we regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. Gifted money, spent pretty much without debate. Salary or professional fee, used after serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement, only with definite need or emergency. This is a framing bias because money is treated differently based on its context. It's the same dollar. It doesn't know who owns it any more than war bonds knew about the war. Another example, from a recent documentary, a woman on the verge of declaring her fourth bankruptcy stated, "You know, the high from shopping is more powerful than the low from bankruptcy." And finally, the parent who says, "You know, I spend so much time at work. When I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it." A justification bias. Now, a compromise can occur when two stories are written simultaneously. And think about that. The preface for this is neuroscientists have demonstrated now that about 95% of our operating systems are unconscious. So what this means, for example, in our money stories is that so much of our experiences of what we've observed, for example, what we've observed our parents and what their money stories are, what money means to them, how they regard money, what they think money can do, how they regard people who have more or less, a whole host of things that never get passed on in words or language, but that are downloaded in an operating system. So consider this in present time. We create a surface story. I want to make significant money and accumulate wealth. Yet some of the model of that 95% of the unconscious operating system has a shadow story. And that shadow story says, "You know, I don't really think I have what it takes," or "Making a lot of money is unspiritual," or, "You know, I really get uncomfortable when I leave my known responses and what I do. I think I'll just kind of settle for where I am." Another example of a dual story of conflict, the surface story. "I want to claim my freedom and become my own authority." The shadow story. "I can't have total authority because my husband acts like I'm taking it away from him." Money speaks to us. Let's consider this. A study was done in which volunteers had their brain scanned using an fMRI when they tasted five different Cabernet Sauvignon. Now, as kind of a footnote here. I have some elaborate mechanisms to get research from around the world, even correspond with a couple of labs and consult with one, but I can never find studies like this to volunteer for. You know, back to the storyline. The volunteers were told before tasting the price of each of the wines. They rated the wines, as you might expect, according to price, the most expensive one the best, and then on down to the least expensive as last. And their brains corresponded. The area of the brain that encode the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, was more active with the more expensive wine. Now, the volunteers actually tasted one wine with five different stories. They experienced more pleasure and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. Money sometimes communicates to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. Money can speak to us as a confidant, seducer, adversary, protector, drug, a limitless number of communications and promises. It serves as a tangible container, maybe, for hope or freedom or ambition or love or disappointment. Money is the one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. And here's the quiz that I mentioned at the beginning of listing three things: current income, what your current annual income is, and then what money means to you. So what the point here is, there's no end point of wanting more. There is no limit to what you don't have. When you focus on more, on what you don't have, you ensure dissatisfaction. Even when you change the numbers, the story remains the same. The story in this case, in the example I gave, I need about twice as much to think I'm happy. That's just one example of common story threads. There are dozens, really hundreds of others, just as irrational, but just as compelling. Now, let's look at your answer to the first question. Money means to me. And as I mentioned, money can make any statement: worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes more developed, most developed, by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs can show up as symbolic wants. A desire is not quieted by its satisfaction, and desires can be created by filling them. Marketers know this. Money is the legal tender of desires. So, what this means is that money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look right at it, there's only a design on paper. But when offered the chance to imbue meaning to that design, to money, the interpretations are going to be as varied as each respondent. People may think money is a reflection of their self-worth or even their morals. One woman said, "I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems." Now, we know that money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps your money. Or even their ethics. President Obama at one point in his first term said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Well, we know better than that. You may work hard, but you may overspend or gamble or have five kids, three of whom are college age, or live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction. Here's a question to consider. Who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Jot down an answer. Just first thing that comes to mind. Whatever group, culture, race, occupation, location, who in America do you think has the best work ethic? Cast the broadest net you can think of. You ready for the answer? Heroin addicts. They get up every morning with a hustle, 7 days a week, plus holidays, 365 days a year. They cannot let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem suffers. One heroin addict said it in this way very succinctly: if I don't get up early every morning and hustle all day, the next day I die. Now, I mention this to not confuse work ethic with performance ethic, especially success ethic. How many times have you heard someone say, you know, I was at my desk and I put in a 10-hour day today? Well, that's great, but what about performance ethic? That trumps any kind of work ethic. Work ethic may be the base, but performance ethic is about what you really do. Success ethic is about what you accomplish. So, now, why do we make these money errors? The more we give money meaning, the more we lose focus on what money really means. And then we do strange things with money. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. I've had two clients who have been Madoff victims. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they just forfeited. Gifted people can't convert their talent into sufficient income. Balanced individuals may spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Otherwise, dependable people can ignore financial matters until they really get serious. Highly principled people can step over boundaries or write their own rules. Others are taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of CyberNet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. Well, Burton listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that may limit or imprison them until they're listened to and strategically changed. And that's what we're going to talk about in the next three seminars. Money has become more abstract. The vast majority of money management occurs not through our own hands or our broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts and emotions and neurological wiring. Here's a 22-second history of money, since you ask. First, a couple of goats were exchanged for five bags of rice. Then, coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange. Coins were then replaced by paper bills, then paper checks, then plastic, then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money becomes more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money fades, and our relationship with it changes. So, what's the role of the mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? The answer is everything. So first, why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people, you probably have this question in your mind about clients or seeing it vividly. What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, and expect a different result? You know, kind of like somebody who doesn't understand English, you repeat what you said a little louder, as if louder English is going to do it. Even when it leads to lower energy or debt or plateaued careers or disappointing relationships. Nassim Taleb, in his book, The Black Swan, asks, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. Now, part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or even uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's our default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out, and that creates the illusion of effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, the old story. People fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means leaving their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. We tend to return to our default mode. This is the most powerful force of the human psyche, that even with a change in behavior, the tendency is to revert back to our core identity, unless that identity is changed, transformed along with the behavior. and we're going to talk about that and how to do that in the roadmap. So let's do a brief exercise. If you can get both hands free, put your palms together, just straight out from your chest and even with your face. Interlock your fingers firmly. Notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers firmly locked together, just the same, but change so that the other thumb is on top. So how does that feel? Kind of goofy, kind of awkward. Now, put your thumbs back in the original place. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. Now, up to ante, add significant success or significant stress, such as a major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. And remember, and you know this, but remember this always, there's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. That's the common, ever-present dialectic. Now, the other answer, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist, actually, Milton Erich, told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path, zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well-worn despite its really circuitous route. Not one single person started a new, more direct route. He did this repeatedly, no matter how many turns and twists on subsequent days. Each person always followed the path of least resistance. No one would start a new path. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences, then repeated until they're etched more deeply, even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. To think creatively, new neural pathways need to be developed outside the cycle of usual experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, new context. This is exactly what we do as mentor coaches. We perturbate a closed system. We ask questions. We collaboratively reflect on experiences of the client. We're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar to engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as anxiety equals danger, better head for cover, I'll go back to what's known and familiar, or reframed in a new context as this is an indication of progress, a signpost of being in new territory. So think about the difference here just in terms of the framework, and this is what we do with new experiences as a mentor coach. So if this newness is read as evidence not to proceed, or, well, my gut's telling me this is the wrong thing, or my intuition says this is not right, when simply this is a reading of something that's new and different, which is expectable in a new experience. Everything that anyone ever does that's new or different begins with some uncertainty and some trepidation. So if this is reframed as validation of movement ahead, it will be self-perpetuating, and someone develops and incorporates this insight and this validation to proceed. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have an error detection mechanism. This is located very close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. We'll talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system. Now, we struggle to embrace change, but the zinger here, many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. This is why, in my view, to incorporate the mind and brain sciences into strategic coaching makes it the most powerful change agent of any kind of work in the world. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operation. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. We're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance to change and to guide strategies of change. We're going to use emotional economics, my trademarked concept, to inform money decisions, even to outsmart our brains at times. We can reprogram our minds and rewire our brains to create wealth and success. So, how do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories, especially in revising or creating new ones? The brain has a mind of its own, and we're of two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by functional magnetic resonance imaging, the same kind of study that I mentioned with the Cabernet. A video of the brain in action as it responds to different situations. These studies have disproven the long-standing assumption that people have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and responses that they choose based on logic. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways. Money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activities. We're going to use these findings to help us inform certain decisions. Here's a glimpse at some examples. The prefrontal cortex says, well, let's think about the 12-month game plan and retirement savings. But the limbic system says, relax, let's have a cognac and order that 27-inch iMac. My amygdala even specifies the brand of cognac and has a specific talent for pairing it with cigars. Each part struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without carrying it. And emotions do not simply and only corrupt decision-making. Emotions narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate. But those who have no emotion are not good at making decisions. It requires a balanced approach, right brain and left brain, emotional and logical. And making people happy is not simply giving them more of what they prefer. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects them to continue. It's been called the anhedonic treadmill, that as you make more money, you buy more things, and it takes more and more just to have the same level of satisfaction. David Geffen said it very succinctly. Anybody who believes that money makes you happy doesn't have money. When someone's stock portfolio does well, they may impute this to their talent and their smartness, and it could be. But gamblers often interpret good fortune as skill. Let me give you a simple example. My wife and I play heads-up poker, and she finally confessed to me after a long time of us playing. She asked me if I would like her to tell me one major tell that I have. I said, yeah, I need all the help I can get. She said, when you draw a really lucky hand, you have a slightly smug look, like you think you're brilliant. No, that's true. The important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't work. The components that don't work don't need fixing. The ones that don't work needs to be revised in order to enhance both your money and your life story. This is one of the simple tenets that you all know from coaching. If it works, do more of it. If it doesn't work, do something else. And to discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money. Your life can be changed significantly by changing your money story. Money's a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money's going to make them more drunk. If someone is insecure, money's going to make them more paranoid. If someone's caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. The most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money or finances. It's about understanding how our minds and brains work and how that affects our behavior, including about money. The beliefs and decisions and seemingly inexplicable behavior involving money isn't about money at all. Money is a portal to the immaterial and the intangible. So, we began a journey to understand the choice architecture of your money story. You write your money story, live it, can revise it, or write an informed, powerful new money story. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. Any thoughts, and if you'll manage the background noise, any thoughts, questions, things that you'd like to talk about, or first just any clarifications of what we've talked about so far? How's this sounding to you? Well, good. I was beginning to feel a little lonely there. Go ahead and follow up. Anything you'd like to further discuss about what we've talked about so far, or anything that doesn't make sense to you?
Hi, David. This is Wes Gilliam. I just wanted to...
Hey, Wes. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Great. Welcome. Go ahead.
I just wanted to mention, you know, it's kind of interesting when you made a reference to the comfort zone. I printed out a quote today that, and I don't know who the author of the quote is, but it says, don't be afraid to fail. Take risks and get out of your comfort zone. This is the only way you will achieve success, by constantly putting yourself in a situation that you are likely to fail. And so that was very interesting, and it kind of coincided with what you said earlier.
And thank you for sharing that. It is a ubiquitous experience. We all, every time we try something new, we are a little bit uncomfortable or uncertain, and our brain's error detection mechanism says, this isn't right, this isn't what I expect, because the brain is wired to do what's familiar, to predict the familiar, to create neurons and neuronal pathways and networks, to make what we do in a routine way automatic, the default mode. So when we do something different from that default mode, it's going to read as discomfort. Think about you drive the same way to work every day. Ultimately, you create a way that you don't even have to think about. Our brains, from an evolutionary perspective, have manufactured a way to create pathways and neural networks that can be in charge of that so that it doesn't have to use as much energy, so it's economic from an evolutionary perspective. But what it means is we don't have to think about it. We can ultimately listen to an audiobook. But then one day there's construction, we have to snake a way through the neighborhood and think about it. You can't listen, you can't pay attention to that audiobook. You have to work at it, it's more work. And there's the discomfort of having to do something different. This is a ubiquitous experience. We all have that experience when we do something different. So that's why it's important, I think, as we work with clients, to empathically resonate with their experience of uncertainty or discomfort. And it's not something you take personally. But the client is simply showing us what it's like to be him or her, and we can resonate empathically with that and be with them and help them understand the process instead of it being misread, for example, as I mentioned, of, well, my intuition is telling me this is not the right thing. Well, their intuition is very important, but that's a misread to say that the discomfort of doing something new is your intuition telling you it's not right. It's your brain telling you it's not what you expect. And it's going to be more work to do something different. Yeah. Mm. So thanks very much, Wes. That's great. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Hi, Dave. This is Philippa.
Hey, Philippa. How are you?
All right, thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm about the surface story about money and the shadow story and how much more powerful sometimes the shadow story can be. You know, I had a little group on Saturday and somehow money came up. And there was a significant shadow story keep coming up about unworthiness and a story and the past story of how they were raised and what their parents thought about money and how it still affects them, the surface story that comes up for them wanting to make more money or doing things to make a significant amount of money, but never being able to come up with a number as to what amount they want to make, whether it's $100,000 or $1 million, or it's just a vague idea about making money. But what was very, very significant there was the unworthiness, that shadow story that keeps coming up. So, you know, I find this part is very powerful for when
absolutely.
I'm having
things like thank you for mentioning that, because it really highlights something that we know as coaches and help our clients do, is to listen for and help our clients listen together with us for the surface story and the shadow story, and for the client to recognize that they create both, that they are the author of both stories, and especially when those stories go in equal and opposite directions and they feel stuck, they're constructing both stories simultaneously. So it's important to recognize they're the author of that, not the victim of it. It's not because this is the way it happened in the past. It's because it's being written in the current moment. So whatever, as you know, whatever we think and feel and experience, we create each moment. It's not there until we create it. And the other point that you make is to have an endpoint, as we were talking from the very beginning, about knowing what enough is.
Yeah.
And the difference between a goal and a good idea. You know, here's a good idea. You know, I'd like to generate more money and create wealth. Here's a goal. I will make $220,000 from coaching and $215,000 from products in the next 11 months. You know, everybody has good ideas, at least some, but to have a goal and a specific plan and strategy to get there, that's the difference. And that's how our brains work like a travel agent. Where do you want to go? When do you want to get there? Once we program that in, we can have a strategic way then to get to where we want to go.
Right.
Great point. Thank you.
Thank you.
It is an interesting. Your group is a wellness group, right?
Are you speaking to me there, Philippa?
Yes.
Yes, I do wellness, yes.
And isn't it interesting how wellness then kind of transmorphs to talking about money, because financial well-being and financial wellness are a huge component of wellness.
Yeah.
So it's no surprise.
Very interesting, yeah. I'm so happy that you're running this course, so now I can, you know, really get an opportunity now to explain it at a deeper level. And another thing that you talk about here is understanding how our mind works and our relationship with money. I emphasize when I'm doing my groups that my focus is really on mindset. And talking about trying to explain to them about what their relationship is with money is how they handle their money right now.
And that's what I want to comment on and highlight too about right now. When you talked about a deeper understanding, what I want to emphasize that as mentor coaches, we don't go into depth of anything, in my view. We listen more explicitly and more simply than the client has ever listened before to this moment and these words as a way of recognizing their story. And we only have to listen very carefully and explicitly and very simply to the immediate, right now, what's on the surface. Anything from any of the depths or any of the past if it's going to influence or be a hidden assumption or a blind spot, it's going to manifest in the present, and when it manifests, it's alive right now, part of a current story, and that's where we can help them look at, does this make sense, or is this something that's working right now? So we're only focusing on the choice architecture of this moment and how someone is constructing their story right now. And we're going to talk some more about that, and you know a good deal more about that, having done the, you know, the Neuro Story Wellness training. So thank you for highlighting that, and it reminds me to be sure that we integrate this at a later point. Well, we're out of time. Please feel free to send me emails, especially to those two questions. They're helpful to me to shape some of the discussion and the examples. And thank you for your response and your energy already. I appreciate it, and I look forward to our continuing collaboration. So
thank
we'll
you.
Pick up right here next time. Thanks very, very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you, bye.
Bye-bye.